UK Wine Show number 198. David Taylor from Bacchus Wine Closures and the Nano Corp. Good day. My name's Chris Scott and welcome to the UK Wine Show. This week we're talking with David Taylor from Bacchus Wine Closures. They own the technology and developed the technology for the Nano Cork. The Nano Cork has got a plastic type lid on each end of the cork, and that stops cork taint, but more importantly it helps manage oxygen flow through the cork. But before we have the interview with David, we've got a full show including news and views and the book review, The Billionaire's Vinegar. I've had a pretty busy week here in Queensland and Sydney and spent quite a bit of time working on 3050. We run wine tastings in Australia as well as the UK. I did pop up to the South Burnett wine region in Queensland, Queensland's second geographical indicator, or GI region as they like to call it, and had some interesting methods of picking wines to try and manage the harvest time around the rainy season. I have a show to catch up on that later on the year, so do stay tuned for that. But speaking of the Aussie rain season, it looks like the lakes are filling up in Australia. Even South Australia's got some rain. I'm not sure if that means the drought's completely broken, but much of northern Australian coast was underwater while I was there, so there's been a fair bit of rain up here. Right, let's crack into the show and start off with we have our mystery wine region. Our mystery wine region's vineyards tend to be planted on old riverbeds in deep, stony and free-draining soils, which ensure a good supply of minerals to the vines. Climatically, the area is similar to Marlborough with low rainfall, high sunshine hours and cool nights. Pinot Noir in particular is a stunner from this New Zealand wine region. Have a think about the mystery grape variety. Next up, we've got the news, which is being read again by me. I actually had a complaint. Well, not really a complaint. Tim from California said that he wanted Jane brought back, and I don't blame him on that. I agree with that sort of sentiment. And to slow down the news, so I'm going to read it a wee bit slower. So next up, we have the news. Laithwaite's have opened a flagship store in Vinopolis in London with a high focus on high-end wines in the £10 to £20 price point. The Wine Club, part of the Direct Wines Group, already has 10 shops in the south of England, but its core business is selling wines by mail order and the internet. The Vinopolis shop has been previously occupied by Majestic, but closed in 2009. Laithwaite's has also appointed former Waitrose buyer Justin Howard-Sneed, we've had him on the show, as the Global Wine Director, offering another signal to the trade that they are serious about moving their offer up the price ladder. Okay, the next story is all about white Burgundies. Producers in Burgundy are under attack from critics, who claim that many of the wines are undrinkable when they should be at their peak due to premature oxidation. The wines include some of the most prestigious Burgundies, including Meursault, Montrachet, and the problem has been first noticed in wines from the 1995 vintage. Critic Stephen Tanzer brought it to the public's attention when the 1996 vintage showed similar signs of early oxidation. Since then, a dedicated website sprung up with the wiki site Oxidized Bergs, detailing vintages and producers concerned. Now, while all whites gradually oxidize in the bottle, going darker and developing different flavors, it shouldn't happen to fine Burgundies for several years and sometimes decades. Explanations for the problem include climate, production techniques, and the quality of cork, but producers deny there's a problem exists and aren't replacing the wines, according to a report in the La Figaro newspaper. So it's pretty tough. If they've got really lots and lots of oxidation problems, they probably don't have the stock to replace them anyway. So it might be a case of buy your old Burgundies at your own risk, which is always been the case anyway. And the last one is a bit about the cork industry, since we've got an interview coming up next about corks. The world's second biggest synthetic cork producer, Newcork, has gone bankrupt, saying it has been hit by the economic downturn and the strength of the Australian dollar. The South Australian company was established in 1996 and chaired by former Constellation Wine CEO Stephen Millar. It hoped the business could be sold as a going concern, though, although it's got an estimated debt of $4 million Australian dollars. Newcork has subsidiaries in California and Spain and are producing about 1.3 billion closures a year. So that's a fair old number of closures. I think plastic corks have probably been hit a wee bit by the rise of Stalvin. After all, why would you go plastic when you can go screw cap? which does seem to be a better technical closure than plastic corks. And you can get them on and off pretty easy. Okay, next up though, we have our second clue in our mystery grape variety. I did say our mystery region was in New Zealand. Our mystery region is based around the town centre of the region, Wairarapa, an hour's drive from New Zealand's capital, Wellington. Grape growing has been carried out in parts of Wairarapa since the 19th century, but planting really kicked off in the 1980s when geologists identified it as a superb area for growing grapes. Have a think about that. And next up, we have the spotlight. Now, this week, I'm reviewing the book The Billionaire's Vinegar by Benjamin Wallace, and it is an excellent book that's part mystery, part wine history, and a guide to how not to buy wines in auctions. It lifts the veil on the fine wine market, with almost everybody coming off poorly. But through the book, you learn about the tricks of fraudsters, as well as the latest techniques that are applied to determine the authenticity of old wines. The story is based loosely around a set of 1787 wines claimed to be owned by ex-American President Thomas Jefferson. The wines were discovered by convicted wine fraudster Hardy Rodenstock, who, despite refusing to give information where the wines were discovered or how many bottles were discovered, the wines themselves were sold off by top wine merchants as the genuine article. Ultimately, the wines were showed to be forgeries, as the engravings on the side of the bottles were shown to be created using a modern electric engraver. This has been accepted by many, but Christie's, who also sold some of the wines, denies this, but refused to release their own investigations into it. Throughout the book, it paints the old fine wine auction business being less concerned with providence, i.e. where the wines come from, and more about selling the wines for the best possible price. The book's really divided into two parts. The first half of the book is focused around the fine wine auction market and those who purchased and drunk them in the 1980s and 90s. And while the second half of the book focuses on Bill Koch, a wealthy American businessman and wine collector, investigating and trying to extract revenge on Rodenstock for selling him what he claims to be fake wines. Note the word that I use, claims to be fake wine, since Rodenstock, while successfully prosecuted in 1992, a German court found that Rodenstock had knowingly offered adulterated wine for sale. No case has been brought against Rodenstock for these particular fake wines for technical reasons, which seem to be based around the statute of limitations. The book itself has actually been part of the story, with Michael Broadbent having the book banned in the UK. Michael claims the book destroyed his career. And reading the book, it certainly puts his credibility under a withering spotlight. But the libel case is not based on that spotlight, but on a rather minor point in the book. In actual fact, I knew the case about the libel case, and I was looking for what the libel case was on. I couldn't find it. I then had to go on the internet, check out exactly what it was, and then I spent an evening searching through the book after I'd read it, trying to find the one sentence that Michael claims ruined his career. So a bit disappointed the book's been banned in the UK because it's such an excellent book on such a small technicality. But Michael does not come through looking like roses at all. In the end, I found this book to be fascinating and impossible to put down once I'd started to read it. It's both educational, and Benjamin Wallace has brought old wines to life with a creative narrative. Those who are in the wine business will find this book a really great read. This is certainly not a book that's pitched at the beginner, and anybody can enjoy this book through a great story and lots of interesting tidbits. In the end, I rated this book 95 out of 100, which I think is an excellent score and the second highest I've given any book. So if you can get it, do have a read of it. And you can get it from Amazon.com. You have to buy it from the US if you're in the UK. But definitely get it, and I had no problems getting the book shipped to me. Right, from old bottles of wine that need constant recorking due to their age, through to modern-day corks. Next up, we have David Taylor from NanoCork. David's going to talk to us about NanoCork's technology and what they hope to be a revolution to the cork. Let's have a listen to what David has to say.
Hi, we're here with David Taylor from Bacchus Wine Closures. How are you, David?
Great, thanks, Chris. Great.
Excellent. What's Bacchus Wine Closures? It's obviously something to do with wine, but...
We actually make a technology which radically improves wine corks. And we've just licensed it to the second largest Portuguese cork company in the world. And it's going extremely well.
Who's the second largest Portuguese cork company?
It's Alvaro Coelho and Imaus, based in Porto.
And what is the, what is it? I've seen the cork. It's, it looks like a, pretty much like a normal cork to me, the glossy ends.
Yeah. Well, it isn't, it is a natural cork, and that's, particularly why we've gone for this. Basically, we wanted to improve all the defects with natural cork. Natural cork, if it worked properly, would be the best form of closure for wine. Everyone knows that. But unfortunately, it has defects. And, whilst the cork industry has overcome the problem of TCA to a good extent with any of the quality companies, particularly the one that we're with, Alvaro Coelho, that you still end up with natural randomness within the structure of the cork, which causes random oxidation and premature oxidation. So basically, by putting our coating on the end of the cork, we eliminate that randomness, the bottle variation you get from the random oxidation.
Looking at the coating, it just looks... So, let's describe the cork first, because it looks like just a bulk standard cork with a couple of glossy plastic ends to it, or clear plastic. Is that, would that be an accurate description?
That's an accurate description indeed. But it isn't clear plastic.
There's lots of oxygen through.
Absolutely right. We've got something which is a high-performance barrier film. The sort of thing that was used in wine boxes, bag-in-box, a sort of thing that's used for covering meat trays to preserve meat in the supermarkets. It lets through about a thousandth of the amount of oxygen as a similar or equivalent polythene film would do.
And how does it perform compared to a plastic cork then? If you've got plastic on the ends, does it... The plastic corks let loads of oxygen in, so...
Yep, indeed.
Is this... plastic barrier here better than a normal plastic cork, for example?
Oh, it is substantially better than a normal plastic cork. In tests, you'll find that a plastic cork, the wine will start going off from the moment it's put in the bottle. And by about 9 months, with your average plastic cork, the wine is heading to be undrinkable. Some of the better ones will last for longer. Basically, a plastic cork is a foam of polymers, and polymers are like, if you imagine a mass of spaghetti in a colander and you're pouring water, it gets through the gaps in the spaghetti, and that's the effect that we get. What we've got in ours is a high-performance polymer barrier. It's a chemical called EVOH, which is very thin. It's only 5 microns thin within the film.
What is it, EVOH?
EVOH, it's ethylene vinyl alcohol. Anyone will know about it. It's incredibly well used, known to be perfectly safe, but it has this capability of stopping oxygen getting through. So effectively, all the technology of the polymers is to put that layer of 5 microns of EVOH on both ends of the cork, and it controls oxygen to a rate of 2 cc's per square meter per day.
That sounds a bit Dutch to me. What does that mean?
Well, it's a very, very tiny amount of oxygen will actually get through the cork. But the amount of oxygen that gets that passes through the film into the cork is the equivalent of a good quality natural cork.
Okay.
And by putting it on the corks, we ensure that every cork performs exactly the same. So you don't get this random variation across a batch of bottles.
Okay, that's interesting, because I'm an electrical engineer, and I look at a lot of stuff like electrical things. And to me, the barrier at the end is like a bit of a resistor.
Yep.
There's another resistor in the middle, and then you've got this other natural cork resistor in the middle.
Yep.
So you might have a controlled amount at each end, but you've still got a variable amount of oxygen ingress through the cork. So I can't imagine you'll get exact performance from every cork the same, because you've got a variable amount in the middle.
Because of the very high performance of the film, and because the cork in between can let anything from a similar amount to much more oxygen through, this provides the standard. Effectively, the cork is doing nothing. It's just holding the film in place. The film is actually doing the job, and the cork doesn't add that much more to it. The corks that we're using in the nano cork are basically a moderate grade cork, so there'll be a lot of variability there. Mm-hmm. And all that variability will be less than the capability, you know, much there'll be much more oxygen able to get through that cork than the barrier itself. So all those corks will perform like the barrier.
Okay, so it's a bit like two weirs, really, isn't it? You've got a weir at one end, you know, like in a boat, water passing through.
Okay.
And you've got a big ocean in between.
Absolutely.
And
everything will run at the rate of the weir. Yeah. Good example.
All right. So you've got a... Is it glued on, or how does this bit of plastic hold on to the cork?
Well, it's got to be bonded, and we use something called a reactive hot melt polyurethane. So it's basically...
Sounds flash.
Yeah. It's what makes the... that's what makes the nanocork work, basically. It's a very powerful adhesive designed for bonding wood to plastic. It's used in yachts, in the ocean, things like that. What's remarkable about it is that it doesn't deteriorate in contact with moisture. It's highly elastic. It actually gets stronger in contact with moisture because moisture is part of the reaction that makes it cure. Mm-hmm. So we've got this fantastic adhesive bonding the film to the end, ensuring that the film will never come off in daily use, practical daily use.
So you've got a plastic lab. What about TCA? Is this cork tank getting through?
Oh, yeah. It was designed originally as a TCA barrier. But because it took so long to get it to market, you know, by the time we've actually got it to market, we found that the TCA problem in the industry, at least with quality cork producers, is a very small problem now. For example, the corks that we're using in the nanocork have got an average TCA of 0.5 nanograms per litre. Extractable. And so it isn't acting in the nanocork as a TCA barrier. It's acting as an oxygen regulator. However, if it did have to act as a TCA barrier or a taste barrier, so keeping back cork tastes, it would be highly effective. It's been proven to keep back 15 nanograms per liter of TCA over 4 years, to keep it below the threshold of detection until that fourth year.
Okay, so it is holding back the TCA, but some will eventually seep through at a very much reduced rate.
After 4 years, but not with the nanocork, because the nanocork has so little TCA in it anyway.
You've got the AWRI, which is the Australian Wine Research Institute, is that them?
That's correct, Chris.
And they've done a report. I had a look at your report briefly, and you compared the closure to other closures. You compared it to a Stalvin closure, plastic cork, a natural cork,
yep.
And was there another one?
No, it was just three other closures, yeah.
And what sort of results did you get?
Absolutely amazing. Absolutely amazing. It was very interesting. The test was done over 24 months. The report is absolute. The conclusions are absolutely glowing. The wine, which was a Semillon Blanc, was described as being fresh, fruity, intense, and long on the palate. Whereas the alternative closures had reached the end of their life. Basically, they were honey characters, esters, oxidation, high OD420. So
what's OD420?
It's optical density. So when a wine is oxidized, it starts to change color.
Yeah.
So just an amazing result.
Okay. I saw in the report that the screw cap Stelvin closure didn't perform particularly well, but I have some concerns about that because it seems that they use the same amount of sulfur dioxide as all the other
closures. That's an interesting point, Chris. Yeah, we'll have to go back to the AWRI about that. But certainly, the way they'd done it certainly showed that the screw cap had reduced by the 12-month point and was quite heavily reduced by the 24-month point.
Yeah, maybe if they hadn't put so much sulfur dioxide in, they may have not experienced that.
Absolutely, absolutely.
But that said, we were talking earlier, and I've got some 08 Savvies from New Zealand at the moment, and they're... One of them in particular is very reduced. We're going to have to stop showing it in tastings, which is a real shame because it was a nice wine and it's just getting too reduced under screw cap.
Good. Well, tell them to use the nanocork.
So you've had AAWRI do a study for 2 years.
Yep.
And the closure seems to have performed quite well based on what you're saying anyway and what they're saying.
Amazingly well.
Yep. What sort of length of life do you think the closure has? Because natural cork has to last 20 years for Great Bordeaux.
Indeed.
At least 10 to 20 years is pretty standard. First of all, will the constituent products, the EVOH or the ethyl vinyl alcohol, get the hang of that now, and the way you've bonded it together, will that last an indefinite period of time or does it have a finite life?
We don't know. Theoretically, it's got an indefinite life. They're very robust chemicals. But we simply haven't tested it for more than 2 years, but longer over a 5-year period with Alvaro Coelho, and they found consistency. It's not fallen apart or anything.
It's not the first closure I've seen with a glossy plastic end. I've seen other corks, and you were saying earlier there was a company called Pro Cork They must have been the ones I saw. What's the big difference between your one and, say, Procork?
Well, we're still in business and taking off, and Procork sadly have retrenched considerably. They had an operation in Portugal, which has now closed down. They don't appear to be marketing in North America anymore, or in Europe as far as we can see. So sadly, they're not around.
But what is the difference in your product?
They didn't use the same adhesives that we've used. It was a different film, and they had a problem with the film coming off the corks, changing colour, and overclaiming, basically, without testing it for long enough. We've tested for 5 years before we've got ours out in the market, and we know it works.
Okay, and how many people are using your clothes at the moment? Can I go to Tesco's and buy a wine that's got one of your clothes?
No, certainly not. We've only just launched it. Alvaro Coelho are now marketing it around the world in all their operations in South America, North America, Europe, now Australia, and hopefully New Zealand, actually, this month. The actual number of people who are using it, there's a well-known Vino Verde company in Portugal, there's a company in Rioja, there's one in Italy, and literally yesterday I heard that we've got our first company in North America.
How does it compete on price then? Because screw caps aren't expensive, they're not cheap either, and you're saying you're using medium-grade quality cork, so yep. Obviously the natural cork itself can't be too expensive. How does the extra cost of the equipment add to the total cost of the cork?
It's a relatively tiny amount. The actual materials are actually 0.04% of the total mass of the cork, so it's a tiny addition. But obviously, there are special chemicals that are used. But the total thing comes to just under the price of a screw cap. It's cheaper than a screw cap.
Okay.
So that gives us that competitive edge to go into the screw cap market.
Are you manufacturing the corks yourself, or how's it being done?
Yeah, no, we don't manufacture anything. All we manufacture is intellectual property and designs. We've licensed this to the second largest cork company in the world, Alvaro Coelho. They have automated machinery now, which applies the film to the corks.
You said it's being marketed all over the place by them, I presume.
Yes.
Is there anywhere I can get a bottle of wine?
Portugal, Italy, Spain, probably, if it's out in the market now. But you know, all the companies that are now bottling have tested for quite a long time, so they're bottling with a good level of confidence.
Well, good luck to your closure. I think we'll wrap up the interview there, David. But thanks so much for your time, and it looks pretty good.
Well, it's a pleasure, Chris.
Cheers, mate.
Thank you very much.
Cheers. I hope you enjoyed that interview. David mentioned that there's random variation in the structure of cork that causes variable oxidation in wine. And this is very true. I did notice this week that a company called Cork Supply had invented a non-invasive, non-destructive, patent-pending technique to be able to correctly analyze the internal structures of individual corks. Nowadays, they just look at the sides of the cork to see what sort of variations and defects they can see from the sides and how much oxygen will slip down the side, which is where most of the oxygen gets in, which we didn't really discuss in the interview. But Cork Supply are imaging the internal parts of the cork looking for faults that can lead to premature failure or oxygen ingress. The company claims they can improve consistency of the cork performance. Certainly by examining corks or applying film such as in the nano cork, the cork industry is meeting the competition, and at last true innovation is coming along. May it continue. Okay, just to finish up, we've got our mystery wine region. The answer was Martinborough. The Martinborough wine region is based around the township of the same name, Martinborough, in the region of Wairarapa, an hour's drive from New Zealand's capital, Wellington. Grape growing has been carried out in parts of the Wairarapa since the 19th century, but planting in Martinborough started in the 1980s after a geologist identified it as superb for growing vines. Martinborough vineyards tend to be planted on old riverbeds in deep, stony, free-draining soils, which ensure a good supply of minerals to the vine. Climatically, the area is similar to Marlborough with low rainfall, high sunshine hours and cool nights. Pinot Noir is a particular stunner from New Zealand's wine region, and I'm actually going to be popping over to Martinborough tomorrow to do some podcasts, so there will be some shows from there soon. Right, just to finish up was this week's quote, which is from the book Billionaire's Vinegar by Benjamin Wallace, and was reportedly said by Andrei Chalchevsky. I don't think that's how you say it, but he's from Napa Valley, and it was apparently said at an auction held by Michael Broadbent after sampling some very old wines. Tasting old wine is like making love to an old lady. It's possible. It can even be enjoyable, but it does require some imagination. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.